Jody had the faked photograph in her hand. She crouched and held it out to him. He blinked and focused on it. His mouth was working, just a ragged hole in his beard. Reacher ducked down and caught his left wrist, dragged his hand up and took hold of the little finger. "Questions," he said, "and I'll break a finger every time you lie to me." Rutter started struggling, using all his strength to twist up and away. Reacher hit him again, a solid blow to the gut, and he went back down. "You know who we are?"
"No,"
Rutter gasped.
"Where was this picture taken?" "Secret camps," Rutter gasped.
"Vietnam."
Reacher broke his little finger. He just wrenched it sideways and snapped the knuckle. Sideways is easier than bending it all the way back. Rutter shrieked in pain. Reacher took hold of the next finger. There was a gold ring on it.
"Where?"
"Bronx Sioux,"
Rutter gasped. "Who's the boy?"
"Just some kid."
"Who's the man?"
"Friend,"
Rutter gasped. "How many times have you done it?"
15, maybe,"
Rutter said. Reacher bent the ring finger sideways.
"That's the truth,"
Rutter screamed.
"No more than 15, I promise. And I never did anything to you. I don't even know you."
"You know the Hobies?" Reacher asked. "Up in Brighton?" He saw Rutter searching through a mental list, dazed. Then he saw him remember. Then he saw him struggling to comprehend how those pathetic old suckers could possibly have brought all this down on his head.
"You're a disgusting piece of shit, right?"
Rutter was rolling his head from side to side in panic.
"Say it, Rutter,"
Reacher yelled.
"I'm a piece of shit,"
Rutter whimpered. "Where's your bank?"
"My bank,"
Rutter repeated blankly. "Your bank," Reacher said. Rutter hesitated. Reacher put some weight back on the ring finger.
10 blocks,
Rutter shrieked. "Title deed for your truck?"
"In the drawer."
Reacher nodded to Jody. She stood up and went around behind the counter, rattled open the drawers, and came out with a sheaf of paperwork. She flicked through and nodded. "Registered in his name. Cost $40,000. Reacher switched his grip and caught Rutter by the neck, bunched his shoulder, and pushed hard until the web of his hand was forcing up under Rutter's jaw.
"I'll buy your truck for $1, he said. "Just shake your head if you've got a problem with that, okay?"
Rutter was totally still. His eyes were popping under the force of Reacher's grip on his throat.
"And then I'll drive you to your bank," he said, "in my new truck. You'll take out $18,000 in cash, and I'll give it back to the Hobies."
"No," Jody called. $19,650. It was in a safe mutual. Call it 6% for a year and a half compounded.
Okay,
Reacher said. He increased the pressure. $19,650 for the Hobies and $19,650 for us. Rutter's eyes were searching Reacher's face, pleading, not understanding.
"You cheated them," Reacher said. "You told them you'd find out what happened to their boy. You didn't do that. So now we'll have to do it for them. So we need expense money."
Rutter was turning blue in the face. His hands were clamped hard on Reacher's wrist, desperately trying to ease the pressure.
"Okay?" Reacher asked. "So that's what we're gonna do. Just shake your head if you've got any kind of a problem with any part of it."
Rutter was dragging hard on Reacher's wrist, but his head stayed still.
"Think of it like a tax," Reacher said. "A tax on cheating little pieces of shit."
He jerked his hand away and stood up. 15 minutes later, he was in Rutter's bank. Rutter was nursing his left hand in his pocket and signing a check with his right. 5 minutes after that, Reacher had $39,300 cash dollars zipped into the sports bag. 15 minutes after that, he left Rutter in the alley behind his store with $2 bills stuffed in his mouth, one for the silencer and one for the truck. 5 minutes after that, he was following Jody's Taurus up to the Hertz return at LaGuardia. 15 minutes after that, they were in the new Lincoln together, heading back to Manhattan. Evening falls in Hanoi a full 12 hours earlier than in New York, so the sun, which was still high as Reacher and Jody left the Bronx, had already slipped behind the highlands of northern Laos, 200 miles away to the west of Noi Bai Airport. The sky was glowing orange, and the long shadows of late afternoon were replaced by the sudden dull gloom of tropical dusk. The smells of the city and the jungle were masked under the reek of kerosene, and the noises of car horns and nighttime insects were blown away by the steady whine of jet engines idling. A giant U.S. Air Force C-141 Starlifter transport was standing on the apron, a mile from the crowded passenger terminals, next to an unmarked hangar. The plane's rear ramp was down, and its engines were running fast enough to power the interior lighting. Inside the unmarked hangar, too, lights were on. There were 100 arc lights slung high up under the corrugated metal roof, washing the cavernous space with their bright yellow glow. The hangar was as large as a stadium, but it held nothing except 7 caskets. Each one of them was 6.5 feet long, made from ribbed aluminum, polished to a high shine, and shaped roughly like a coffin, which is exactly what each one of them was. They were standing in a neat row, on trestles, each one draped with an American flag. The flags were newly laundered and crisply pressed, and the center stripe of each flag was precisely aligned with the center rib of each casket. There were 9 men and 2 women in the hangar, standing next to the 7 aluminum caskets. 6 of the men were there as the honor guard. They were regular soldiers of the United States Army, newly shaved, dressed in immaculate ceremonial uniforms, holding themselves at rigid attention, away from the other 5 people. 3 of those were Vietnamese. 2 men and a woman, short, dark, impassive. They were dressed in uniform too, but theirs were everyday uniforms, not ceremonial. Dark olive cloth, worn and creased, badged here and there with the unfamiliar insignia of their rank. The last 2 people were Americans, dressed in civilian clothes, but the sort of civilian clothes that indicate military status as clearly as any uniform. The woman was young, with a mid-length canvas skirt and a long-sleeved khaki blouse, with heavy brown shoes on her feet. The man was tall, silver-haired, maybe 55 years old, dressed in tropical khakis under a lightweight belted raincoat. He was carrying a battered brown leather briefcase in his hand, and there was a garment bag of similar vintage on the ground at his feet. The tall, silver-haired man nodded to the honor guard, a tiny signal, almost imperceptible. The senior soldier spoke a muted command, and the 6 men formed up in 2 lines of 3. They slow-marched forward and right-turned and slow-marched again until they were lined up precisely, 3 each side of the first casket. They paused a beat and stooped and lifted the casket to their shoulders in a single fluid movement. The senior man spoke again, and they slow-marched forward towards the hangar door. The casket supported exactly level on their linked arms, the only sounds the crunch of their boots on the concrete and the whine of the waiting engines. On the apron, they turned right and wheeled a wide, slow semicircle through the hot jet wash until they were lined up with the Starlifter's ramp. They slow-marched forward up the exact center of the ramp, feeling carefully with their feet for the metal ribs bolted there to help them, and on into the belly of the plane. The pilot was waiting for them. She was a U.S. Air Force captain, trim in a tropical-issue flight suit. Her crew was standing at attention with her, a co-pilot, a flight engineer, a navigator, a radio operator. Opposite them were the loadmaster and his crew, silent in green fatigues. They stood face to face in 2 still lines, and the honor guard filed slowly between them all the way up to the forward loading bay. There they bent their knees and gently lowered the casket onto a shelf built along the fuselage wall. 4 of the men stood back, heads bowed. The forward man and the rear man worked together to slide the casket into place. The loadmaster stepped forward and secured it with rubber straps, then he stepped back and joined the honor guard and held a long, silent salute. It took an hour to load all 7 caskets. The people inside the hangar stood silent throughout, and then they followed the 7th casket onto the apron. They matched their walk to the honor guard's slow pace and waited at the bottom of the Starlifter's ramp in the hot, noisy damp of the evening. The honor guard came out. Duty done. The tall, silver-haired American saluted them and shook hands with the three Vietnamese officers and nodded to the American woman. No words were exchanged. He shouldered his garment bag and ran lightly up the ramp into the plane. A slow, powerful motor whirred, and the ramp closed shut behind him. The engines ran up to speed, and the giant plane came off its brakes and started to taxi. It wheeled a wide, cumbersome left and disappeared behind the hangar. Its noise grew faint. Then it grew loud again in the distance, and the watchers saw it come back along the runway, engines screaming, accelerating hard, lifting off. It yawed right, climbing fast, turning, dipping a wing, and then it was gone. Just the triangle of winking lights, tiny in the distance, and a vague smudge of black kerosene smoke tracing its curved path into the night air. The honor guard dispersed in the sudden silence, and the American woman shook hands with the three Vietnamese officers and walked back to her car. The three Vietnamese officers walked in a different direction back to theirs. It was a Japanese sedan, repainted a dull military green. The woman drove, and the two men sat in the back. It was a short trip to the center of Hanoi. The woman parked in a chain-link compound behind a low concrete building painted the color of sand. The men got out without a word and went inside through an unmarked door. The woman locked the car and walked around the building to a different entrance. She went inside and up a short flight of stairs to her office. There was a bound ledger open on her desk. She recorded the safe dispatch of the cargo in neat handwriting and closed the ledger. She carried it to a filing cabinet near her office door. She locked it inside and glanced through the door up and down the corridor. Then she returned to her desk and picked up her telephone and dialed a number 11,000 miles away in New York. Marilyn got Cheryl woken up and Chester brought round into some sort of consciousness before the thick-set man came into the bathroom with the coffee. It was in mugs, and he was holding them two in one hand and one in the other, unsure of where to leave them. He paused and stepped to the sink and lined them up on the narrow granite ledge under the mirror. Then he turned without speaking and walked back out, pulled the door closed after him, firmly, but without slamming it. Marilyn handed out the mugs one at a time, because she was trembling and pretty sure she was going to spill them if she tried them two at a time. She squatted down and gave the first one to Cheryl and helped her take the first sip. Then she went back for Chester's. He took it from her blankly and looked at it like he didn't know what it was. She took the third for herself and stood against the sink and drank it down thirstily. It was good. The cream and the sugar tasted like energy. "Where are the stock certificates?" she whispered. Chester looked up at her listlessly. "At my bank. In my box." Marilyn nodded, came face to face with the fact she didn't know which Chester's bank was, or where it was, or what stock certificates were for. "How many are there?" He shrugged. "1,000 originally. I used 300 for security against the loans. I had to give them up to the lender, temporarily."
"And now Hobie's got those?"
He nodded. "He bought the debt. They'll messenger the security to him today, maybe. They don't need it anymore. And I pledged him another 90. They're still in the box. I guess I was due to deliver them soon."
"So how does the transfer actually happen?"
He shrugged again wearily, vaguely. "I sign the stock over to him, he takes the certificates and registers them with the exchange, and when he's got 501 registered in his name, then he's the majority owner."
"So where's your bank?"
Chester took his first sip of coffee. "About 3 blocks from here, about 5 minutes walk, then another 5 minutes to the exchange. Call it 10 minutes beginning to end, and we're penniless and homeless on the street." He set the mug on the floor and lapsed back into staring. Cheryl was listless, not drinking her coffee. Her skin looked clammy. Maybe concussed or something. Maybe still in shock. Marilyn didn't know. She had no experience. Her nose was awful, black and swollen.
The bruising was spreading under her eyes. Her lips were cracked and dry from breathing through her mouth all night. "Try some more coffee," she said. "It'll be good for you." She squatted beside her and guided her hand up to her mouth, tilted the mug. Cheryl took a sip. Some of the hot liquid ran down her chin. She took another sip. She glanced up at Marilyn with something in her eyes. Marilyn didn't know what it was, but she smiled back anyway, bright with encouragement. "We'll get you to the hospital," she whispered. Cheryl closed her eyes and nodded, like she was suddenly filled with relief. Marilyn knelt beside her, holding her hand, staring at the door, wondering how she was going to deliver on that promise.